want to begin this morning with a story that I have, that I read about three or four times since Thanksgiving. And the reason I spend so much time on it is because the story is so very beautiful as an introduction to the celebration and preparation for Christmas, and that it gets us on the right path. And so I read the story about three or four times by myself, I mean, other than in my presentation. And my point is that the story is so revealing and so helpful to me personally. Each time I read it, it kind of catches me in the throat a little bit, because there is a certain aura to it, and it touches us in our depth. It's from Annie Dillard, who was one of the great Catholic writers of our time. And she has a number of books. You'll never go wrong picking one of them up. The reason I like her is that when you read the book, or even one of her short stories, and you put the book down, you can go in a number of different directions. Your thoughts can carry you on, and all of those lines of thought and development would be productive. They would be, you'd really end up with some very good resolution in your mind and heart. So that's why I like her. And so we'll read that story, and then we'll proceed. One cold Christmas Eve, I was up unnaturally late because we had all gone out to dinner, my parents, my baby sister, and I. We had come home to a warm living room and Christmas Eve. Our stockings drooped from the mantel beside them. A special table bore a bottle of ginger ale and a plate of cookies. I had taken off my winter coat and was standing on the heat register in the hallway to bake my shoe soles and to warm my bare legs. There was a commotion at the front door. It opened and cold wind blew in around my dress. Everyone was calling me. Look who's here, look who's here. I looked, it was Santa Claus, whom I never ever wanted to meet. Santa Claus was looming in the doorway and looking around for me. My mother's voice was thrilled. Look who's here, look who's here. I ran upstairs. Like everyone in his right mind, I feared Santa Claus, thinking he was God. I was still thoughtless and brute, reactive. I knew right from wrong, but had barely tested the possibility of shaping my own behavior, and then only from fear, and not yet from love. Santa Claus was an old man whom you never saw, but who nevertheless saw you. He knew when you had been bad or good. He knew when you had been bad or good, and I had been bad. My mother called and called, enthusiastic, pleading I wouldn't come down. My father encouraged me. My sister howled I wouldn't come down. But I could bend over the stairwell and see Santa Claus standing in the doorway with night over his shoulder, letting in all the cold air of the sky. Santa Claus stood in the doorway, monstrous and bright, powerful, ringing a loud bell and repeating, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas. I never came down. I don't know who ate the cookies. For so many years now, I have known that this Santa Claus was actually a rigged-up Miss White who lived across the street, and that I confused the dramatis personae in my mind, making of Santa Claus God and Miss White an awesome, vulnerable trinity. This is really a story about Miss White. Miss White was old. She lived alone in the house down the street. She liked having me around. She plied me with cookies, taught me things about the world, and tried to interest me in finger painting, in which she herself took great pleasure. She would set up easels in her kitchen, tack enormous slick soaking papers to their frames, and paint undulating undersea seams, horizontal smears of color sparked by occasional vertical streaks, which were understood to be fixed kelp. I liked her. She meant no harm on earth, and yet a half a year later, after her failed visit as Santa, I ran from her again. That day, a day of the following summer, Miss White and I knelt in her yard while she showed me a magnifying glass. It was large, strong, handheld. It was a lens. She lifted my hand and, holding it very still, focused a dab of sunshine on my palm. The glowing crescent wobbled, spread, and finally contracted to a point. It burned. It burned me. I ripped my hand away and ran home crying. Miss White called after me, sorry, explaining, but I didn't look back. Even now I wonder, if I meet God, will he take and hold my bare hand in his and focus his eye on my palm and kindle that spot and let me burn? But no, it is I who misunderstood everything and let everybody down. Miss White, God, I am sorry. I ran from you and I am still running. Running from that knowledge, that I, that love from which there is no refuge. For you meant only love and love, and I felt only fear and pain. So once in Israel, love came to us incarnate, stood in the doorway between two worlds, and we were all afraid. The story is, kind of story in that you can take in a number of directions, but the reason I use it at the in the Advent season as kind of a meditation is because of it reflects the reality that Christmas is really a two-dimensional kind of thing. If you consider what the spiritual dimension of Christmas is, it celebrates the fact that God has become human flesh in each of us, and that God has come among us and has bridged the gap between the divine and the human, no longer creating a space between what we are and what God is. And that mystery addresses the deepest parts of us. And so Christmas goes in that direction, and that story takes you there. But also that Christmas has a multiple manifestation of so many things at Christmas. You think of all of the ways you prepare. You think of all of the things that you do. It's so manifold in its expression, and you're celebrating this core truth of God becoming human and becoming one with us. And I mean the whole entire thing that you do getting ready for Christmas, from putting the lights on the front of the house, on the bushes in the front of the house, as everyone does, all the way to the last minute visit to the beer store to make sure you have enough for all of your guests who are going to be coming around. And what I like about the story is that it combines the two elements, all of the many multiple manifestations of Christmas and the core meaning of what Christmas is. And for the person who is grounded, and that's my point, I would like people to be grounded in such a way that they can take the core meaning of Christmas and then allow it to emerge from us and express us itself in the multiple dimensions of Christmas, all the way from the gift buying to the decorating to the partying. And to the person who is grounded, you bring those two things together, and then they can feed each other. The celebrations and the joy and the fun and the lights and the tree and the trains and the entire picture and scene of Christmas feeds the core event, which is God becoming flesh, and the idea of God becoming flesh feeds these core events. And that's what I like about the story. It doesn't let these things be imposed. I think the Knights of Columbus and the evangelicals in our country miss a great opportunity, actually, to actually express what it is that Christmas is. And that is that God, the ultimate reality, the divine God Spirit, ultimate God Spirit, has descended into, or ascended into, if you want to use that word, both of them work, into humans and into flesh. And therefore, all of these multiple manifestations of Christmas, all of these lights and all of those things that we do are perfectly in tune with the celebration of what Christmas actually is, which is the invasion of our flesh by God. And I think they miss a great opportunity, because what happens is they keep they hammer away on the commercialism of Christmas and the gift shopping and all of the secondary celebrations. They hammer away at those, and well, actually they can bring them together and actually make their point. And they can make it more strongly if they would see what it is that they are doing. But for you and I, we know how to do this. Further, this descent of God into humans, the perfect, which is perfect spirit coming into flesh, I want you to think a moment about the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And as soon as he dies and rises, what does he do when he rises? He goes immediately to flesh. And he carries a flesh that is transformed and translucent and new and fresh. But he carries a flesh. And what this means is that this flesh and humans is the place where God's action is. Why does God descend into human flesh? Why does God not stay where the hell he belongs? Up in the sky, away from all of us. Because all religions really want God to do that. Most religions want to get you out of flesh, get you out of the human, and get you into some nirvana or some state of non-existence, some state of non-being. Whereas we believe that this movement of God, this movement of perfect spirit seems to be unfulfilled unless it becomes human and becomes flesh. So I think that mystery or that revelation is really helpful to us. And I ask you this, what would a totally, absolutely spiritual celebration of Christmas look like? If you said, we're only going to celebrate Christmas spiritually. No nothing. No meal, no nothing, no. What would it look like? It wouldn't look like anything. And I think that's the point. If you go in that direction and forget what it is that Christmas actually celebrates, I don't think you get to what you really want to get to. And if people continue to try to oppose spirit, flesh, God, and human, on the December 26th, here's what's going to happen. You're going to have a low-level depression. You're going to feel a little bit guilty because you didn't get it. You're going to feel a little bit guilty, a little self-loathing, because you haven't celebrated Christmas spiritually. My point is that you can bring them both together as they truly and really are. All of these multiple complex manifestations of Christmas are really the expression of the internal understanding of what it is that God has done. So my point is that if you're grounded, you bring both of these things together and are able to celebrate both the primary understanding of Christmas and all the secondary manifestations of Christmas just very nicely. And it will also enable you, with all of the confusion around you, and Christmas is a confusing time, especially if you have children. I mean, they are unbearable at this time. But if you have grandchildren, same story. You have all this action going on around you, conflict, movement, and you, a parent or someone who is in that kind of an environment can immediately begin to become defused. Confused, and then you have to defuse yourself away and say to yourself, wait a minute, this is what it's all about. It's about God entering all of this confusion. And once you settle yourself with the fact that God is present in this hilarity and movement and confusion and noise and back and forth you go, and you keep reminding yourself that God's in this stuff. And when you do that, then it defuses the situation and you feel okay. So you can go to the Eucharist, eat communion bread, and pass drumsticks. Okay? You can listen to Christmas carols on high and celebrate a profound silence, so silent that you can't even hear a mouse. You can listen to Handel's Messiah and watch National Lampoon Christmas and those other very funny Christmas stories. What's that one? Is that guy Chevy Chase?
Yeah.
You can watch those stories and have a good time. And you can wrap the perfect gift for the perfect person. And as you're wrapping that perfect gift you bought for your perfect person, you can imagine that you are wrapping gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And that the wrapping of that gift is given to one as sacred as the one that is in the manger. And that's exactly what he tried to say. That person is the ultimate presence of God in your life. And you can decorate the tree from top to bottom beautifully. And then as you look at the tree and then you turn out the lights in the room and you look at this beautifully decorated tree with all the colorful lights and all the glitter, and you look around her and see how beautiful it is, you can get a sense of what it is that God experienced when he became flesh. You can see some of the beauty that he noticed as he descended into our life. And so all of those things then invite us to celebrate Christmas in all of its secondary manifestations. What I would like to do now is to take a little bit in a general way, in broader terms, the celebration of Christmas, and then, of course, try to break it down in its individual pictures and individual symbols of the Christmas season. And as you know, what I've done here is I put, you know, have any of you seen the movie The Nativity? I saw it.
No.
Worth seeing. It's worth seeing. As a presentation of the story, it's good. Decent story. But what it is, it's a story that combines both what we would call the Matthean story and the Lucan story. And they're different stories. They agree only in one or two places. So they both come at the story differently. I put here Herod because he's a big part of the story, but he's not in the crib scene anywhere. He doesn't get any. And J.B. is a big part of the story. John Baptist is a big part of the story in Luke, but he doesn't make it to St. Francis' scene. This is a 13th century production. The Christmas Creche is a 13th century effort by Francis in the parish church in Assisi to try to teach people what it is that the event comprised in God becoming human. So you got Herod and his pieces over here. You got Luke and his pieces over there. Now, Herod, in his story, he has the visitors, the magi, the wise men, the kings, call them whatever you want. He has them in his story. And, of course, they're right here carrying their little pot of gifts. And over here you have the camel. Now, if you didn't know, suppose you never knew. You never knew this story. You came and you looked and you saw the camel, or you think the story is about camels. Because they're the biggest piece of the story. They're the biggest statue. You would say, hey, this is a story about camels. But one of the things you have to notice is that, you know, the three camels in that story of the Nativity were prominent. And they're not even in the Bible. But they're prominent in the story. And so you have these camels carrying these three amazing visitors who are stargazers and find their way in the story. And Herod, of course, is the pursuing arm of justice, trying to pursue Jesus' mother and father. And then you have Jesus and Mary. They are in both stories. They're somewhat difficult beginning, told in both of the stories. But over in Luke, so this is a very serious story over here in Matthew. Very serious, somber. It's like a drama in which will they catch him? Will they get him? Will they find the mother and father? Will they kill the baby? And he kills a number in the story anyway, but doesn't get this one because he gets to the crib and the crib is empty. And there's a who's here, and they can't find out who's here. So, but if you go over to the Lucan narrative of the story, it begins with two very wonderful and ebullient announcements of a birth. The birth of J.B. To Zachary and Elizabeth, and the birth of Jesus to Mary and Joseph. Two great announcements. And then there is then the birth, and who's here, and they can't find out who's here. So, but if you go over to the Lucan narrative of the story, it begins with two very wonderful and ebullient announcements of a birth. The birth of J.B. To Zachary and Elizabeth, and the birth of Jesus to Mary and Joseph. Two great announcements. And then there is then the birth, and they, in the story, they go to Egypt. In the story, they go to Egypt afterwards, but the story has Jesus sit in a manger, which is an important piece of the story itself, and the visit of the shepherd boys that arrive there because they have been told by a choir of angels in the sky that this is about to take place and they better hurry themselves in there. And so Luke has to take place and they better hurry themselves in there. And so Luke's got the angels. If you want to take a look at the Lucan story is like a song in which angels are singing, Mary is singing when she gets to Elizabeth, so she gets her own piece there. says more in that piece than she does throughout the entire Gospels, in Joseph is Lost. In that one song she sings to her cousin Elizabeth when she goes to visit her. She sings to her cousin Elizabeth when she goes to visit her. And then there's a drummer boy. I don't know where he came from. He's not in the story, but he's here. Okay? So when you're telling stories, then you can add to them and subtract to them as you go, and all of the animals there as well. But both of them tell a different tale. Luke, of course, and then Matthew, each come at the story a little bit different than than each other, and then they move forward in that. Now, what I want to do now is to talk a little bit. This celebration of Christmas and this scene that I put here was not celebrated for 325 years in the church. We didn't celebrate Christmas. The death and resurrection of Jesus Christ was the historical foundation of the community of the believers in Jesus. They did not celebrate any other event. The birth of Christ was not even at this point thought of. And the idea that God would become human and that he would descend into flesh was not the kind of a thing that they thought should be celebrated, because they were still resistant to the idea that God would be one of us and that he would adopt our flesh and become human with us. So when it finally was celebrated, it's important for us to notice that how it came about. Why did we begin to celebrate the birth of Jesus? There was an emperor by the name of Constantine whose mother was Helena. Helena persuaded her son to become a Christian. When Constantine became a Christian, he was at that time a worshiper of the sun, and the Feast of the Sol Invictus, which is the Feast of the Unconquerable Sun, was on December 25th. You'll also notice that that is the time of the year of the darkest, and when the day is darkest, and there's more dark during the day, certainly more than there is light. And so the Unconquerable Sun begins to come back after December 25th. So he decreed in the Roman Empire that the birth of Jesus would be celebrated on the Feast of the Sol Invictus, which would be December 25th. And from that moment on, the church, all churches, celebrate the birthday of Jesus on December 25th. So what it is, if it hasn't been around for 300 years, it's actually an artificial construct, if you know what I mean. Advent is an artificial construct that talks about the birth of Christ that wasn't celebrated by the community for 325 years. So what we have here is an artificial moment in the Christian year in which we get to renew. And I think that word becomes very important, because we are renewing the birth of Christ within us. He's already present, but we are renewing that through our contemplation and our watching and looking at this story in Matthew and Luke. We're renewing our faith, we're renewing our life through our contemplation or our look at this story. But please understand that this is, in a sense, it is artificial. St. Francis gave us the scene, and then we celebrated after that. And it was also at this time that the believers, the Christians, began to see the Old Testament as the source of many of the images and symbols in the story that would be created by Matthew and Luke. So when they look back in the Bible in the Old Testament, they find certain parallels. When they find that the father's name is Joseph, and they compare him to Joseph of the Old Testament. When Joseph goes down to Egypt, he becomes the savior of his brothers in the story. So Joseph, in Matthew's rendition of the story, when Herod is in pursuit, he takes the child, the mother, and he goes down into Egypt and stays there for a period of time and then the child will come out of Egypt, as did Joseph to save his people. Now, if you're Jewish, you're listening to this story, and you're saying, right on, that works, that fits. You know, it's all part of it together. And remember, story is far more important to them than truth. The truth of what happened on the night that Jesus was born is far less important than the way Matthew and Luke would tell the story years later, because they're telling you the meaning of what it had, or the meaning of God becoming human. And what emerges from that story is going to be the thing that fills in this renewal that we have at Christmas time. Now, if you consider this, 40% of the art, 40% of the art and music in Christian history is about the Nativity. It's about this. The rest of the life of Jesus and the moments of the life of Jesus do not get much attention at all. But this Christmas story keeps about 40% of the art and music. And Jesus is seen then as the new Moses to a Jewish audience, and it also becomes very attractive for the Gentile, this story does. And so the Nativity itself advances in terms of importance, so much so that you could make a case that people observe Christmas more strongly than they do Easter, which is the core event of our Christian faith. They consider Christmas far more important. Okay. Now, I want to take just a few more minutes, and I want to talk a little bit about... John Shea says that unless Christmas will not work, unless we learn how to behold. He goes on to say that in the gospel stories of Matthew and Luke, one of the words that continually is said by the participants in telling the story, Matthew and Luke, keep going, and they keep saying, behold, behold, behold. And if you take a look at a dictionary and wonder what this word behold means, it's the ability to see the thing before you in terms that transcend, and there's a certain radiance to that event or that person who stands before you. The way I like to see it is if you haven't seen anybody for a long time and they come to visit you, there is more to that emotion and feeling than is present there. I mean, you greet them with open arms and you give them a big kiss and a hug, and there's more in your heart at that moment. You're beholding that person. He said that unless we learn to behold, like the story does, behold, 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 unless we learn to see the radiance of things before us, he said you have to pay attention. He said you have to pay attention to the person who's before you. You have to be attentive. You have to not look past them. You have to look at them. You have to behold them. And he said that about the events of Christmas as well. That unless we learn to do that, he says we're not going to really understand what Christmas is all about. And we're not going to be able to share those moments of Christmas that are important. Behold, I think you get a sense of what that beholding means. He said that that's really important. He says that if God and the ultimate spirit that is God has descended into humans and descended into flesh that is around us, the very really real, okay? And he says that if that has happened, then you have to behold this stuff. You have to behold that if God and the ultimate spirit that is God has descended into humans and descended into flesh that is around us, the very really real, okay? And he says that if that has happened, then you have to behold this stuff. You have to behold, okay? You have to behold the person before you. And he said that. He also mentioned that there are enemies to beholding. He said at Christmas time, overbooked, and they become hyper busy, going from one thing to another thing to another thing to another thing, never stopping, and they can't really stop to behold. They're tired, they're worn out, they're beat. All they want to do is go to bed. They can't behold anything at this point, right? And if you have enough of those moments at Christmas time where you're beat, you're going to come at the end of Christmas, you're not going to feel good at all. You're not going to get a sense of a renewal at all. So he says one of the enemies of beholding is being too busy. He said the other enemy to beholding, he said, is the gift giving that we involve ourselves in. He said that our gift giving, he said, has become an attention to the gift and not the personal relationship between the giver and the one receiving the gift. Okay? He said that unless the gift carries the freight of the relationship between the people, he said the gift giving becomes empty and powerless to say anything between the person who got the gift and the person who gave the gift. It just becomes a gift. And the most important thing about the gift is the what? The gift. Not the relationship between the people who give the gift. If we continue to do this, we are going to kill Christmas. We're going to kill Christmas because we forgot what it is we actually do. That is the point that I feel that the Knights of Columbus and the Evangelicals should be talking about. At that point. Let me give you an example of that. Two Christmases ago, I got a letter from a man. And in the letter was a little Merry Christmas, Steve, how are you? It's good to, and I just wanted to share this with you. It was a very large check. A significant amount of money was in the check. And just those words, Merry Christmas. So I took the envelope, took the check, and I got in my car, and I drove to the man's office. And I walked into his office and asked the secretary if I could see him. He said, "Sir, go right in." So I went and I sat down and I said, "What's this all about? What's this all about?" Because it was unpredictable. I didn't know him that well. I didn't know his phone number. I knew where his office was. And I said, "What's this all about?" He began to tell me what it was all about. It was one of those things where I said something at the right moment, at the right time, and it caught on. It caught on. And that's what that was all about. So we talked a little bit. But the point I'm trying to make is that unless I went there and talked to him about it, I would have never known what it is that the gift represented. It was a symbol of something that happened. And unless the symbol is there, the gift giving becomes empty. Another example of it, and I'll show it to you next week. I had my family here last week for Christmas, and I have a very contentious relationship with my only niece. She's in her 30s, and I have a contentious relationship with her. It's a difficult one, but I don't feel really bad because she has a contentious relationship with everybody. But I also have to tell you that I am a participant in the contentiousness because I am just as stubborn as an uncle as I am a generous uncle. And anyway, it was time to exchange gifts last Sunday, and she handed me this gift in a box, and it was very clear to me that it was a mug. But the mug was very unique. I took it out of the box and I realized that it was not a mug you buy in a store. It's a mug that you have something done with. And on the mug, never knew this picture existed, on the mug in the glass,